Hello and welcome to episode 151 of the Crane and Crowbait. What are you doing?
I was bored.
Already?
You made me be quiet. It's 151 episode of the Creighton Crowbar, and it's the 26th of July.
Do you want to do this introduction, Pip?
No, I just thought it would help.
You are helping.
You seem to have lost your thread, so, and I had the info in the brain tank.
Thanks for being there when I needed you.
Oh.
Anyway.
Yes.
Who else is here, Pip?
No one.
No one. No one's here. It's just us now.
Oh.
The reason it's just us is because we're literally the only people who do this podcast left in Britain now.
Oh, yeah.
As Tom Senior has temporarily, I would stress, before people riot in the streets, gone to Canada, leaving just us. Tom Francis is in Sweden. Marsh is in Sweden. Graham is in Jersey.
Yes.
I asked some other people if they wanted to come on, but not very hard.
Oh.
I mean, I did, but you know.
Oh. Well.
It's good, Pip. It's just you and I now. We can talk about whatever we like as long as it's PC gaming news and experience related.
Oh. So can I talk about my book on insect morphology?
No. That's forbidden. That's not allowed at all.
This is the
Incidentally,
worst.
There isn't really very much news that I could see. I was looking for news. Everyone's talking about the Nintendo NX. But we don't care, do we?
We can't.
No,
we're not allowed.
Not allowed to care.
We can care outside the confines of this podcast, unless it has any repercussions for the PC.
But it probably doesn't.
You might get one as well as your PC.
Indeed. So the only news I wanted to draw attention to this week was Rainbow Six Siege's new DLC. And I only want to talk about this, and only briefly, because its name is Operation Skull Rain.
That's crazy. Although I would have called it She Sells Rainbow Six Siege Sells.
That's a better name. Yes. I was tickled by this because...
Sorry, what was it again? Operation
Skull Rain. Because traditionally, like, military operations don't have, like, explicitly, like, violent code names, do they? It's like, you know, Operation Desert Storm.
Wasn't Operation Flashbang a thing?
Are you thinking about Operation Flashpoint?
I don't know.
There's a game called Operation Flashpoint.
Maybe.
It's quite old now.
But there might be two different things. You could have Operation Flashdance as well.
You could.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I was going a bit off-piste, but never mind. But anyway, Operation Skull Rain, which doesn't involve... It involves some Brazilian special operatives. There's no skulls. At all.
But what are the other missions called in Rainbow Six Siege?
Go to the embassy.
What's the rainbow?
It's because they are a multicultural, multinational group of special forces men and women pledged to defend from...
And what's the six?
There's...
Because rainbows have seven colours.
Well, the forbidden seventh colour is skulls, Pip. They're adding.
So what do you do in Skull Rain?
In Skull Rain, I don't know. I didn't read beyond the hilarious name.
Oh.
Which shows how committed I was to...
What kind of rain? Is it like the rain of the king of skulls? Or is it like
skulls from
the sky?
Yeah, as in skulls from the sky.
Okay.
As in precipitation. Area of high precious skulls meets a high area of low precious skulls.
I like it when people get really sort of like... bombastic with their names of things, because you know sometimes it's all a bit po-faced and a bit kind of we're sort of secretly wishing that we were actually in the army at this point. And then, you know, I think that when you not exactly rein it back in, but you bring it back to the point of no with Operation Skull Fire Rain Hats.
Indeed.
Or whatever it was, then you know I'm a bit more comfy with it.
It certainly is stupider like this.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
Anyway, what have you been playing this week?
I made
Pip?
A list.
You did?
I did. I've got my book.
Excellent. Is this the insect morphology book again?
No. No, that's a lot bigger. Lots of insect stuff in that.
Yeah.
So I've played quite a lot of things this week, but little things and only small amounts because work. So you can hear one of the following, or more than one of the following. I'm not sure how we're doing this.
We've got a certain amount of time to get through, Pip, so let's do the whole list.
Oh, so first was Botanicula.
Botanicula.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about Botanicula.
The same developers, I'm not entirely sure, who did like Samarost and stuff. And it's so pretty.
Great.
And Machinarium, I think, as well. But like, I wasn't very into Machinarium because it was doing that point and clicky kind of combine object with object, and like some of it wasn't particularly intuitive to me, and so I'd play it for a while, but then I'd find a thing where I just, you know, couldn't be doing with the puzzle, and then I'd bounce off, and then I'd maybe go back a bit, and then I'd, you know, delete the game, and then I'd, you know, reinstall it and get to the exact same place, you know, the next time. Botanicula, yes, is more of a kind of, it reminds me of a bunch of VHS tapes that my parents had when we were kids for like kids' stories and kind of experimental animations and stuff. Like there was this one that was like line drawings, and it was about the man who stole dreams and kept them in shoeboxes in a cupboard. And then to stop him from stealing the dreams of the townsfolk, I think they pushed him in a box of nightmares, and he was trapped in there forever until the death. But so not exactly a parallel there, but it's kind of like those sort of unexpected, weird kind of experimental things that you'd maybe pop a kid in front of, and, you know, there'd be a lot of joy in, you know, finding the next thing that goes in an unexpected direction. But because of the interactivity, it's kind of maybe more like that, but a jungle gym. Like, you know, you'll press a leaf, and then suddenly, you know, a thing that looks maybe like an ant will come out of it and do something. And then you'll prod another leaf, and a little insect will scuttle to a different hiding place.
So what's your goal?
I don't know. I just liked pressing things. I think at the moment... No, hang on. At first, I was collecting feathers so that a big blob would be able to fly out of my way and I could get further down a tree trunk. And then I think maybe... Oh, there was a spider, an evil spider, or maybe not a spider, but it was like munching things, and the things that it munched kind of died. And so I guess it is bringing pestilence to the tree, and I am maybe trying to solve that.
So it is still like a puzzle game.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel quite as, you know, like you have to follow those incredibly prescriptive logic paths of, you know, interacting objects with objects to solve problems, but it's sometimes just being esoteric or frustrating because this is far more playing with the landscape until it does a thing that you want it to, or until it produces a result that lets you get on to the next thing. But I think that it, because it's an actual nice play experience while you're doing that, it's not the same kind of frustrating experience where you're just trying to arrange the right you know, nouns and verbs to create the next action. It's that you're prodding at leaves and poking at insects and hatching eggs and, you know, all kinds of other stuff just to try and, you know, it,
you sort
know,
of feel you, out a solution.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't even know what the solution would be. You know, you don't even know that it's a puzzle.
Yeah.
So that's actually really just nice and sweet. And
it's an interesting direction to take a point and click in, just to make it sort of an interactive toy box that has some challenge, but not, that's not the point.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's why it reminds me of those sort of slightly more experimental kids shows, or you know, I'm not really sure what that would be at the moment, because my knowledge of children's shows is pretty much Ben and Holly and Peppa Pig.
You're probably watching Let's Plays of Botanicula on YouTube.
Maybe I could do that as a kind of remote daycare, like, business venture.
What, you'll play video games with people's children?
Yeah.
That is being a YouTuber, Pip.
Oh. Well, all right then. It's been done. Shall we move on?
Yeah.
The next item on the agenda. Let me just tick this off.
Okay, good. Yes, excellent. This is the most orderly podcast we've ever done, which I find frankly shocking.
Polybridge.
Polybridge.
Yes.
Who's she?
Well, oh, I see what you did there.
Thanks.
Polybridge is a game where you build bridges and you get things over a river, and sometimes you have to make room for things coming along the river, like tugboats and steamers and things. Are you laughing at me?
No, I'm laughing at the word steamer.
Why?
Don't ask.
This is a poo thing.
Let's move on. Tell me about the bridge construction.
This is
a physics-based bridge construction, is it not?
Because somebody kept laughing about the Steamer Trading Company, which was a shop that sold saucepans.
Where was this?
Back home.
Okay, so not in a game.
No.
Okay.
Anyway, so...
Yes.
I've forgotten.
Poly bridge.
Oh, yes.
Making a bridge. Sometimes little cars, sometimes little boats.
So,
physics.
Yes. What it does is it shows you the gap that you need to cross, and it shows you the vehicles that are going to go across, and like later
puzzles, missions.
Levels of the campaign, the single player campaign or whatever, will have checkpoints and things, and it'll, you know, indicate what order things need to be hit in, or, you know, whether the bridge needs to hold long enough that the thing can come back again, things like that. So and then you have a bunch of stuff at your disposal in terms of building materials. So there's the surface of the road. So this is all sort of, you're generally working in like a 2D view when you're building this stuff. And so you've got road, which can get to a certain point. And so you're clicking kind of on a, you can turn on a grid view, and it's like graph paper. And so you mark out where you want the road to go. And then you have to then work out how to support that road as something goes across. And so you can build sort of those supportive archway side barriers. Or you can try and build a framework underneath the bridge, or you can sort of combine the two. If you really fancy it, or you're trying to save material costs, you can create a ramp so that you only sort of use a fraction of the materials, and then the thing will hopefully land on the other side. And it's kind of, it's interesting, but there's a bunch of stuff that doesn't feel like it quite makes physics sense. Like, there are some bits where you kind of go, oh, okay, I think I just didn't figure that out, in terms of the bridge collapsing when you try and run a little car across it. But there's other stuff where, for example, I tried to use the tensile strength of rope to help stop the bridge from buckling. So it was, you know, actually should have, or it felt like it should have helped my bridge stay upright as something tried to go across it. But adding the ropes to strengthen it actually made the whole thing just fall apart instantly, and it's very hard to tell why that might be. It's super difficult to, so one of the things that you can do is you can slow down a replay, and another thing that you can do is turn on a kind of stress view, so you can see each of the different bits of the bridge, And if they're green, they're fine. If they're orange, they're sort of stressed. If they're red, they're probably about to buckle, and then they get destroyed is the end stage of that. But it's kind of annoying because something will buckle and destroy and you won't have the faintest clue why sometimes. And there's no option that I could find that lets you maybe select an individual bit of the bridge and see which forces are broadly acting on it. And I don't know, parts of it just seemed counterintuitive anyway. So like there's bits where you set up your bridge across the thing and you just use a straight line of road. In one of the super early levels. And to strengthen that, you do a kind of triangle series of struts, you know, series of struts arranged to form triangles as a naturally strong shape along the top of the bridge to sort of form side rails and support it as your vehicle goes across. But there didn't seem to be any need to support the joining points where the road met the riverbank. And so I was kind of like, well, you've strengthened the bridge itself, but what is it that's keeping this thing hinged on land at all? You know, surely that's a massive point of stress and you've only got the road and the point that's designated that you can attach things to. So you know, it's things like that that I found really hard to intuit how they worked. And it started making more sense after I'd been through the manual that it gives you and sort of tells you a bit more about the different material properties and things. And I started experimenting with the hydraulic shaft things. So, you know, you can create... is it the cantilever... the word that I'm looking for? Basically, it creates the tower bridge kind of thing, you know, where the two sides go up to allow something to pass in between. And so, yeah, like that kind of, it's not cantilevered at all, but that kind of thing was
swing
really...
Swing bridge?
I don't know, I'll look it up.
Transformo bridge.
Hinge. Anyway.
Bringe.
Anyway. And so it's kind of interesting and it starts to make more sense the more you play around with it, but it still feels weirdly unsatisfying in some ways. I haven't got to the point with it where I feel like I reliably understand why a piece is changing the bridge in some way, and that for me was the thing that meant that I played it, but then I didn't really go back to it because I feel like it's got a lot of promise, but I wasn't gelling with it because of those things. It sort of felt like this weird, unsatisfyingly unknown.
Where does it sit in the spectrum between simulation and a puzzle game?
I think it's trying to do both, which is probably why it's feeling a bit weird, because it's trying to be super approachable and it gives you like only a handful of basic instructional levels before it sends you off into the wide world. And it also hides pretty much every hint of mathematics or physics in terms of, you know, the actual numbers and the relative strengths of materials and things. You'll find them in the manual. And it tells you that exists at the end of the tutorial, but it doesn't actually run you through any of the technical side of what the game is doing. It just tells you triangles are great. Use those, you know? And so I feel a bit, okay, well, it's trying to make the whole thing super approachable, but feel like that's also maybe obfuscating some key points for me, and that's why I'm still not quite sinking into it.
Hmm. To what extent is the trial and error thing fun, because, or supposed to be fun? Because, so like Kerbal Space Program is a game that's also about physics and making your own contraptions and disasters and stuff, and it's quite far down towards the simulator end of the spectrum, but it is also a puzzle game, but with just naturally occurring objectives. And a lot of the fun of that game comes from the genuine... It doesn't teach you very much. You just learn through doing what's going to fail, what's going to blow up, what's going to turn sideways and explode, and so on. And you have the diagnostic tools to fix stuff. But, you know, the following that game is built up has basically been built up by people failing and going back and trying again and learning. Is this... Is Polybridge fun in the same way? Does it have a promise?
I feel like I should try and spend more time with it to fully answer that. But from what I've played so far, the failures can be fun in and of themselves. For example, you build something that you think is, you know, a really solid project, or, you know, you absolutely nailed it first time kind of thing, and then the car or lorry or ice cream truck or whatever goes anywhere near it, half of it just disappears into the water and the other half is kind of like dangling in some ridiculous way. Or you know, your vehicle goes over it absolutely fine, and then you realize that you misjudged the height by a tiny amount, and so the boat sort of takes out several of the support struts as it goes underneath, and you sort of watch in horror as the next lorry tries to go across after that. So it has some of those moments, but I think that it didn't feel to me like it had the capacity quite to learn from them in the same way, or to truly pick them apart in a way that you then learn a whole lot about the different ways in which you could have solved the problem.
That makes sense.
I mean, it might be that there's a super active community out there that will help you with that stuff, or that there are particular equations or particular formulae or something that would be super useful to have at your disposal, and that, you know, the better you get, the better you are at sort of manipulating those. But it feels too light for that kind of level of engineering and reworking and
Maybe further down towards puzzle game in that sense.
Because, I mean, I got stuck on one particular level and I was just there for ages, and it got well past the point where it was fun. And I felt like I hadn't learnt anything because I still hadn't worked out what the problem was. I'd tried out a whole bunch of different things. I'd tried a whole bunch of different materials. I'd read from the book. And it still just wasn't getting any clearer.
I guess if you're not having fun at that point, then that's the test. But, you know, I suppose some people would.
Yeah, and I wrote about it a few days ago because they've implemented a Twitch thing where you can, if you're streaming the game via, you know, I think you have to set it up and sign up to that particular thing via their official site or something. But the idea is that you can tell your spectators that you're happy to accept bridge suggestions for a particular problem, and then you can take those suggestions and modify them, and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So they're clearly envisioning and want to cultivate a collaborative sort of community of people who want to solve these problems and work together on them. But it, like I say, it's just not gelled for me yet. And
that's an interesting idea,
physics just feels a bit off.
Something else interesting that I saw recently, I don't know full details, but sort of what you just had reminded me is that Telltale's future adventure games will be multiplayer with people voting on decisions, which seems like an interesting, potentially deeply flawed way.
Batman will half remember that.
Yeah. Batman will remember what you got him to do, but not what you voted for.
Batman will bear a grudge over that one.
Yeah. So yeah, as humanity's ongoing democratic adventures continue everywhere, you can live the thrill and disappointment and tragedy of having your choices taken from you.
How does the York do it? Because that's a story, multiplayer adventure thing, isn't it? And I can't remember.
No, I have no idea.
Because I played it at a party with Brendan Caldwell, and all I can remember is some of the colours, which is just my memory, but and it was delightful, but I wish that I could remember how they'd done it.
There are games where it has worked. Star Wars The Old Republic had you each roll a dice to determine who got to speak when your characters were all speaking to an NPC, which is fun. A fun way of doing it, but weird sometimes, and you'll have to go with the decision.
Yeah.
That had the great morality system where if you all made a decision, you all chose what you wanted to do, and then you would roll a dice, and whoever got the highest score would that's the thing you would do, and the other characters would go along with it. But you would get the light side, dark side boost based on what you wanted to do, not what actually happened, which is basically to prevent your mates from dragging you to the dark side against your will.
Oh, that's interesting.
It did create some sort of weird ethical situations where it's like, we did murder all of these, innocent trapped engineers, but I didn't want to do it. Therefore, I'm still an angel.
I think that makes you worse, doesn't it?
Yes, because it makes you a coward as well as...
It kind of reminds me of Stuart Lee's monologue about Richard Hammond.
In what way? Oh, in going along with the other two.
Yeah.
Yeah, the...
He's there basking in his good Jedi points.
Yeah. Either standing either side of Clarkson in the lift forever. Sorry, that's totally off topic. But yeah, I like the idea of people finding, actual, ways to plug into games, multiplayer modes that basically just replicate what people would sort of create for themselves, whether that's sat around playing a Telltale game, talking about what decisions to make or...
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
But it's that thing
trying to solve the puzzle together.
You have to do the thing of... So if you were all on the sofa playing it, or at least making those decisions, someone would have the pad, and so it's that thing where you're trying to figure out the gaming equivalent of who's got the conch.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we tried it when we did FTL by committee one New Year's party round. Tom Francis's, and that was not a total disaster actually. but a good lesson in what a room full of increasingly drunk people will place value on, and what we placed value on was the laser glaive.
See, that has never happened at any party I've been to at Tom's. Mostly I end up arguing with him in the kitchen about who's the best Gilmore girl. It's Emily, by the way.
Every time for
Every
years.
Time. But yeah, so that's Polybridge. Should Polybridge, I tick it off
tick
the list?
It off the list.
So I try and make it so that people can hear the tick. Hang on.
Try it. I hope that was satisfying people at home.
People heard
or I didn't get destroyed by whatever noise cancellation or compression I'm going to do to this audio. Shall I mix in one of my games now?
Yes, please.
So we keep it bouncing.
Do you want me to write it down so we can tick it off?
I guess. So I haven't played a lot this week because I've played a lot of those too, but I there'll be riots if I talk about it.
Shall I write it down and then we can quickly tick it off?
No, just don't okay. even. They'll know. They'll be able to tell. They won't even like that tick.
Okay.
The forbidden tick.
I'll put a cross. Hang on.
That's the Dota cross. Okay. Yeah. But I've been playing little bits of other things. So I returned to Total War Warhammer.
Oh.
Hmm.
Had you finished your campaign?
So, yeah, my first campaign, which ended up about 240 turns and 27 hours long, was as the Empire, and I think I spoke about the start of it before, and ended really well, actually. The game impressed me for sort of sustaining my interest through a really long campaign by allowing the the pitfalls and the moments where things went south to not feel like big terminal errors that meant better off restarting because something went a bit wrong. And in the end, obviously my goal wasn't to like save the world or anything. It was to meet my victory conditions. And I did so in a... Did you just...
No. No, carry on.
All right. Oh, all right. So skip to the end. You're not very good at hiding when you're bored by a subject, Pip. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Sorry.
Anyway, so yeah. So that was fun. And so I decided, having you know, protected the old world and pretty much, you know, created a thriving human civilization that I was going to try and tear it all down as Chaos, which is the faction that they released as like free week one DLC. And it works very differently. And it has, it's a horde mechanic, which I believe was in Total War Rome 2 Attila.
Was Attila the horde?
It was...
I mean, the Hun, but yeah. I mean, was that
yes,
the,
I think
the faction?
I believe so. I might be getting my expansions in a twist, though. So if I'm wrong, I don't want to dwell on it too substantially. But that means that rather than... You can start new armies and things, but your armies are also sort of bases unto themselves in each sort of... Because they make camp somewhere rather than establish a city. And when they're making camp somewhere, you sort of draw troops to them and upgrade them, and you pick up all your upgrades and you move somewhere else. And so it's pretty difficult because it puts pressure on you from the beginning to keep making progress, keep taking settlements, keep your sort of renown building, because you don't have money as Chaos. You have the favor of the Chaos Gods, which is basically money. And all the other interactions, like there's equivalents to ransoming soldiers back to the original owners and so on, that it's just like, you know, sacrifice them to Khorne or whatever.
Khorne.
The god of skulls, actually. He would love a skull rain.
Khorne.
Khorne, the murder god.
Why is he called Khorne? Surely Khorne is like the thing that you associate with vegetarians and...
That's Khorne.
No, but I mean actual, like, the grain.
It's like, not spelled Khorne.
It's like it's the spelled... opposite of meat.
It's spelled K-H-O-R-N-E.
K-H-O-R-O. Okay, fine.
Khorne, the god of murder and skulls. And also meat replacement tofu products.
So is the Chaos faction the one that has the ghasts?
No, I believe that's the undead or the vampire counts.
So what do you actually have? You've got these mobile bases, but what are your units?
My units are mostly Vikings. Sort of burly men who run in a straight line at people while shouting about skulls. That's essentially what they do. And quite a lot of wizards, including Archaon, the Ever Chosen.
He's forever chosen. I think I kind of thought that this Chaos faction would be a lot of, like, you know, formless or, there is, you know, like, so spectral.
There's quite a lot of mutations and monsters. So I have some mutant dogs. There's a Chaos spawn, which are, like, big, hulking, former people with tentacles for faces and so on. Sort of softly Lovecraftian. And I get more of that stuff as I rank up. Because it's Chaos Warriors rather than Chaos Demons, which they're all related, but... In the Warhammer setting, those things would be slightly different. And it is fun, but... And maybe I need to dabble around some of the other factions as well before I settle on this. I had this feeling that I did enjoy my first run through that game. I had a feeling that jumping into another faction would because they're so different to each other, which is one of the game's big advantages over its historical cousins, is it can just do completely different things for the different factions. I had a feeling like it would feel like starting a new game, not just a new campaign but a different Total War. And it is very different, but I've carried through some of the fatigue I was left with at the end of my Empire campaign. Because the end of my Empire campaign, I was like, I'm kind of done with these guys now. I know my battle plan. I know which battles I'm just going to auto-resolve, and that's a lot of them, and so on. And already in the Chaos thing, it's like, I can't be asked to fight this. I think, I don't know, lacking the sort of, my territory's getting bigger satisfaction, there's a sort of aimlessness to it. And also, because it's probably one of the harder ways to play, there's a feeling that you actually can get dicked over and you can't really come back from it. Because Chaos is a lot about momentum. And when you're playing as any of the other factions, chaos will invade periodically, and it's a big deal. These armies just roll out of the northern wastes, and you have to stop them. And that creates... They are the mechanic that creates drama for everybody else. They create, you know, frantic alliances and all this other stuff to push them back. And then when you do push them back, it feels like a big achievement, but you know they'll come back. When you're playing as them, you actually feel a bit weedy in some ways because you know your own lack of strength, really. And you can't go to all the places and you can't have all the armies you want because you have to build it up. And it's actually one of the harder ways to play. And I think that's a really interesting idea, but it hasn't really grabbed me. So about a couple of hours into campaign two, I'm probably going to sack it off and play dwarves.
Okay.
But I would be interested to hear if anyone sort of like found a way of playing chaos that does feel impactful. I suspect it might start to if you get a good start. But that was sort of the reason I liked Total War Warhammer in the first place, was playing as the Empire, it didn't feel like you needed a really good start in order to have an interesting campaign. Whereas an early setback with chaos feels like, because you're basically being chased around the north by angry Vikings that aren't you, pretty much from day one of Chaos Camp. So
maybe chaos is more the faction that you play when you've exhausted playing the others, and you want that kind of challenge where you might just be able to fuck it up, or you'd have to be super good to claw it back if
that's very possible.
You messed it up because it was the extra faction, right?
Yeah.
So maybe it's there as a kind of super difficult thing, as well as a, you know, nod to particular Warhammer players and aficionados.
Yeah. So I sort of wanted to play as them because I just like that faction, and but I imagined that. Perhaps you're right that it's designed to be a sort of end game challenge for people who've had their fill of orcs and dwarves and goblins and Austrians.
What's the big foot?
The big foot?
Yeah.
The big green foot. That's, I think, the foot of Gork, which is like a god of orcs.
Oh, okay.
Which is why his name is Gork.
So is he friends with Khorne?
No.
Who is friends with Khorne?
Well, no one's really friends with the Chaos Gods, even each other. There's four of them. Technically five now, but... Sorry. Okay, so there's Khorne, who's Skulls.
Wheaty.
Wheaty Khorne.
Oaty.
There's Nurgle.
Rice. Nurgle.
Yeah, who's the god of, like, pestilence and
disease. I thought people were joking when they said Nurgle.
No, it's Nurgle, god of snot.
It's just like how there's that game that you can play with rolling dice and then you can get farkled.
There's a game you can play with rolling dice which actually has Nurgle in it called Warhammer.
Oh.
And then there's Slaanesh, who is the god of, like, pleasure and hedonism and...
Sounds cool.
And, like, you know, sexy, sexy, sexy times. Ish, but also deadly sort of violence suits. And bondage and stuff. And then there's Tzeentch, who is the god of change.
No one talks about Tzeentch.
I like Tzeentch, he's my favourite.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that just because, like, you feel a bit sorry for him? Is this like how I used to say...
No, it's because he's basically an homage, shall we say, to the coolest Lovecraft god.
Oh, okay.
Which is Neil Athetep, who is based on...
Neil
Athetep.
Is this like David Atherton or something?
No. Yes, his name is Neil Athetep, because there's Cthulhu, Azathoth, and Neil.
Look, I'm just trying to make sense of this.
No, okay, so it's like, maybe it's Niall Athetep. It's spelled NYARLATHOHTEP.
Okay.
I think. So...
I'll add it to my Christmas card list.
I think, a genuinely interesting fact, but we'll find out. Who is actually an enigmatic sort of presence that shows up in a couple of Lovecraft's dream stories. Apparently, accounts of real dreams. He's sort of this enigmatic figure. It arrives in a city and everyone kind of goes mad and just follows him out into the desert, essentially.
Is he the Pied Piper?
Sort of. Imagine like a kind of cosmic Pied Piper. Like a sort of trickster god. Whereas, like, you know...
He would be useful to have in your campaign.
He would, yeah. Mm. But that's what kind of Zinch is as well. But Neil Athertep is actually based on Nikola Tesla.
I'm sorry, I can't stop hearing Neil Athertep.
But yeah, so Lovecraft saw Tesla do his demonstrations of electricity when in the turn of the century, or yeah, whenever it was, the early teens, I guess, 100 years ago, and had, you know, this idea of a sort of traveling performer, salesman, god that basically changes the fabric of reality underneath people came from that. I thought that's an interesting fact.
So is Nikola Tesla a chaos god?
Kind of, yeah. Huh. Tangentially.
Interesting.
Nikola Tesla is Zinch's granddad.
Huh.
Yeah, there you go. That's a totally un-PC game related fact.
Well, yeah, we should probably get back to PC games.
Indeed, that's basically all I've got to say about Warhammer.
Oh. So how has it got? You were saying that you might actually sack it off soon, but okay?
It's all right. Like, because I have one really big army and like another army. So there's an attrition mechanic. So like the attrition is a thing that basically is used to prevent you from just sitting huge armies in positions that would probably break the game. So if you are the Empire, for example, and you want to invade the Northern Wastes to get rid of them, you suffer terrible attrition on your soldiers while you're in there. Like, so you send an army up to the Arctic, basically, and they die constantly as long as they're there. Okay. So you can fight for a bit, but you've got to get out if you want to not just all die in the snow.
So it's an environmental thing.
Yeah, it's like an environmental hazard, basically. Okay. You lose this many troops as long as you're here. Yeah. And there are other variants on it. Like, you lose troops as long as you're standing in an area that's been tainted by the undead or whatever. Chaos don't have that in terms of like where they're standing. And I think the same might be true for orcs as well. Like, so the chaos can hang around the frozen wastes forever, as far as they're concerned. Okay. However, if two of their hordes are next to each other, the hordes kill each other through infighting. So you have to keep your armies kind of like a safe distance from each other, like naughty dogs.
You have to keep your armies away from your legsies.
Indeed. Indeed. And your tentacles. And your skullsies.
That was such a dad joke. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. But yeah, so that's sort of like annoying and fiddly more than anything else at the moment. But also, the campaign AI and how the AI moves armies around, what it attempts to do, has always been weird in that series. And I think when you are one big army running around trying to like sack settlements, and it exposes some of the flaws that aren't as readily apparent when you're managing three fronts of a big empire. Like, you can, and the whys and sort of hows of what the AI does is sometimes baffling, like for both you and your allies. So one thing you can do as chaos is like sack a settlement of like Norse villages and say, you're part of chaos now, and they don't join your faction, but you can then tell them where to go and who to attack, and they build up their own little hordes. And so that's part of the idea, is you have the main horde, but you can just send them off to do things. And I sent one after some dwarves I needed to kill. I just ran a lap of some mountains for a while. I just watched this army for a couple of turns, just run in a big circle, fail to do what the thing I told him about, and then vanish.
Oh.
So that wasn't very helpful. and then...
This is not Operation Skullfire or whatever it was.
Yeah, Operation Skull Rain, which is actually a better name for this campaign than it is for a Rainbow Six expansion. The other thing that was like... The joy of these games is in sort of spinning the story out of the things that happen in the mechanical strategy game. So the sort of the ongoing tale of this civilization or this leader or this battle or whatever. And in the last session I had with it, there was a dwarven stronghold, which is this big underground dwarven city, like really hard to siege, up in a mountain. And below it was a dwarven seaside town, basically like a kind of like an industrial city on the edge of the snow. And the city, the little city, was really, really well defended, and no one was in the dwarven citadel. And so I encircled the little city for a while to try and starve them out or get them to attack me so I'd have an advantage or something. And they didn't. They just sat there. So I moved my army up to the main city, just around the corner and up the mountainside, and lay siege to that. And then as I was doing that, I got an alert that on the dwarves' turn, they'd moved their entire army from the city to the citadel via underground tunnels that link the two. And if I wanted to, I could drop into the tunnels on top of them and ambush them. But they still had more people than me, so I just figured I'd just let them. And then the next turn, I just left and went back to the city, which was now completely undefended, and sacked it with almost no opposition and razed it to the ground. And so maybe there's a, you know, there's a story to be spun out of that in terms of like, oh, you know, they thought I was going to attack here, but actually I fainted and went back the other way and they were all, you know, fucked. But actually, it was, I think, the AI figuring that it could move faster than me, so it could just keep moving the armies between the two to shore up wherever I was attacking. But the fact they had access to this underground tunnel was just as fast as me running across the surface. So in the end, it just felt like I'd sort of gypped the AI out of something by like tricking it into moving its troops and then taking the undefended thing. And that's not smart enough to be gratifying.
Okay.
So I kind of want to go back to having like a civilization and diplomatic relationships that I need to look after. Because that's the other thing. Everyone hates you. So you're not trying to bribe people to keep alliances together or anything like that. You're just a... You are essentially a deus ex machina. You're there to roll out of the north and force everyone else to have to make interesting decisions.
Do you think this is how the Burning Legion feels?
What, a big deus ex machina that no one ever really wants to be friends with? Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, the Burning Legion is based on chaos.
Yeah.
I mean, Warcraft, everything in Warcraft has a pretty strong analogy for something in Warhammer, just with fewer skulls, generally.
Well then. No.
Take it off the list, Pip.
I have written it down.
Oh, shit.
Toad.
All that time.
What? I didn't want to seem rude. Warhammer. Tick.
Hooray. Nice. What's your next game?
Well, we can talk about Clock Sim.
Clock Sim?
Yes.
Clock Sim.
Clock Sim. Clock Sim. So it's a game that is essentially based around your ability to keep time in seconds. And so it just has a whole...
Sounds great.
Shut up. I just picked it up because it sounded like one of those things that could either be interesting or it could be Goat Simulator. And
those are the two... That could be on your review scale.
And it was actually kind of interesting because... And I don't know how much of that was me bringing my own thoughts to a medium and it just reflecting those back at me. And if I'd been in a completely different mood, it would have been awful. But essentially, there's a whole bunch of different game modes and they pretty much all revolve around... See what I did there? Revolving like a clock.
Clocks don't revolve, Pip.
The hand does.
Does it?
Yeah.
I suppose it does. I always thought it revolved as a horizontal motion.
But that's
like you're doing
not
a hula
how...
hoop.
Anyway, so...
That's not helpful. No.
So essentially, you have what is a basic clock face on the screen in front of you in the first version of the game, and you click once on your mouse to start the second hand moving, and then you click every second just from that point onward. And if you go too fast or too slow, then it lops a little amount off the second hand, and when that wears basically all the way down to a knob, that's over. And essentially it's just if you are good at keeping time in terms of seconds, then you get to click seconds for longer. And I don't know, for me that was just sort of funny in and of itself as a thing that you are doing, and your reward is to sort of waste more time. Your reward for being good at time is wasting it. But also, I am so bad at estimating a second. It's crazy. And usually I'm too fast. Like, I just think seconds are just, you know,
shooting by.
None of this Mississippi nonsense.
Let's try it now. Pip, all right.
Well, no, I uploaded some YouTube videos so people can see this. It's infuriating.
Still, all right.
Even when I watch it back, it's awful.
Count out like 3 seconds.
Okay. One, two, three, I guess. Hang on.
I'm not sure if you fucked up timing or counting.
No, but I mean, you asked me to count 3 seconds, but then you didn't step in, so I didn't know whether you'd suddenly developed a hankering for more seconds. Or
just love time. Pips can't get enough time.
So I have no idea how that would have gone. Like, I have no idea, and you have no way of measuring this.
Well, we are literally recording this.
Yeah, but I mean, right now, you can't give me feedback, but the game could.
I literally could if I turned around slightly.
Well, you didn't, did you?
All right, no, seriously, let's try again.
Oh, this is the worst. Okay,
we're playing it live.
1, 2, 3.
That last one was about 2 seconds, but sure.
Well, oh, this is ridiculous.
Anyway, so this is probably not the highest grade of games analysis we've
heard
from
back
Prophet.
Tom. Any of them.
And we want a Tom.
And so, I just quite liked knowing that I still haven't internalized this man-made construct. Like, that's interesting to me, is that seconds are like this foreign entity that just seems to have absolutely no bearing on my natural way of approaching life.
That surprises me not at all.
Well, no. But also it probably explains why I'm absolutely terrible at music, just in general, is because, I mean, I'm surprised I could dance, you know? Like, maybe that's because the music does the timekeeping for me. Like, if I had to do my own, you'd just find me sort of convulsing somewhere in this weird sporadic fashion, you know, just like an arm
here,
and
leg here. I think
you
might be a chaos god. I generally have this feeling.
But, and then there's some other weird modes where, like, you're typing in time with the seconds, but it's because you're trying to move a pig in between some cogs, and the cogs will tell you like the letter that you need to press, and so that's a thing that happens. But yeah, so it's kind of weird. I'm incredibly bad at it, but it's one of those things where I actually just think it's quite sort of funny, and it can just provoke some interesting thoughts if you happen to be in that philosophical, possibly soody frame of mind like I am a lot. Should I tick that off?
Tick it.
Tick.
Click. Clock. Yay. Click. Clock. That's not what it sounded. No. That's somewhere between a horse and a clock.
Well.
That's where I live.
Well, I don't really know how to respond to that.
How about with your next game?
Grow Home.
Grome.
Yes. It's that one about the robot who falls to Earth and has to do things to grow a plant to get back to, I don't know, his spaceship, probably. It's really annoying. Loads of people
really liked it. Yeah,
and
I heard that.
He's so jittery and it's really annoying me. Like, for some reason, I'm just finding absolutely no pleasure in the controls. It's an interesting way of doing things. I'm playing it on a control pad, and you use the, I think it's the shoulder buttons to grab on, you know, and so, you know, you press them one after the other, and that's the process by which you climb or latch onto things and then sort of, you know, traverse them as you sort of climb this thing that is essentially the magic faraway tree, I guess. Well, no, it's not really, because the magic faraway tree was more about what's at the top. And also who lives on the side. So nothing like this. It's a big tree. But I'm just not enjoying it. Like, I'm not enjoying the movement because he's so floppy as a robot and sort of unsteady on his feet. And I find that inexactness can be quite punishing. Like, I'll find myself falling because he was sort of tottering, and I'm not like a big fan of that.
You just don't like tottering.
Well, I mean, I do it enough. I mean, you know, there's no reason I have to put up with it in games as well. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those things that's that adds personality and is endearing and things, but I don't tend to react well to that anyway, so I sort of find it
frustrating. You're not a fan of whimsy.
Not really.
No.
And then I don't... the climbing mechanic of the button pressing is interesting for a while, but then after a while it's I just get fed up with it. Mm. And so I've extended the tree a few times and I've picked up some of the crystals and things, but I really am not getting that fondness that other people really seem to have for the game, and I'm just finding the robot himself annoying to control, but also the sound effects and things from the game are just, I think like the crystals make a noise that sort of sets me on edge, and so I think it's a game that's just primed to
slightly annoy you.
Yeah, and it, or at least just to put me in that frame of mind where I can't quite relax.
Mm.
And so I'll never just zone out and play it. I'll always be tense and on the verge of stopping. And so
it's a shame.
It is. I'm wondering whether the new one, is it Grow Up or something?
Yes.
I wonder if the new one will have changed anything and will...
Mm.
Therefore be a different experience or one that is more rewarding, or whether I'll just find my groove with this, or I'll uninstall it and never go back because I don't care if the robot goes home, to be honest. Heartless. With you, just stay on your island.
You awful tottering whimsical prick.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got stuff to do there. There's butterflies to look at, rocks to move. What does he need to go back to space for? Am I being mean?
A little bit. But he probably deserves it. He's not real.
I'm going to tick that off.
Tick it. Nice.
Mm. We could talk about jalopy if you'd like.
You got stuck in the sausage shop.
I did. So...
I think we've talked about the context for jalopy before, in that you are repairing a car and taking your uncle to Dresden.
Yeah, you've got an old-fashioned car, and you've got all of the very first thing that you do in the tutorial is you put the engine and all of the other bits in the bonnet of the car and get told how they work together and which bits are absolutely crucial for keeping things running and which aren't, and you know, the ways in which you can modify, you know, bits and pieces, the balance of oil and fuel in the engine, for example. And so that's interesting, and I do like the lo-fi polygonal graphics style as well, and the muted color palette and things, and I think those all sort of hang together really well because they seem to fit each other as concepts, if you see what I mean. And so I have booted it up several times. I have started out on the journey to Dresden several times, and I have a uniquely bad relationship with that game. I've never met a game that just seems prone to me finding the only way to fuck it up. And so, you know, you have things like I think the time that I mentioned it before was when I lost momentum going up a hill and then started to slide backwards, but then a car was behind me, so I couldn't go backwards, but I couldn't go forwards. I definitely couldn't go sideways, so I reversed really angrily because someone was beeping me, and then I ended up wedged halfway on top of their car, so I just parked it there and left, and uncle was still in the passenger seat. But this time around, I managed to mess up my tyres so badly that my car couldn't stop skidding. So I ended up facing the wrong way in a tunnel. And then I tried to drive backwards out of the tunnel so that I didn't ram into the oncoming traffic that wasn't moving out of my way.
Mm.
So that was one thing. And then I approached what I now realise was a checkpoint, but I actually thought that it was the police just telling me I couldn't go through a thing. So I went and drove all the way back to Berlin.
Well, Dresden's closed. We're going home.
So I got a bit confused by that. And then, but no, on the way back to Berlin, I realized that that's what it must have been. So I was trying to find a place to do a U-turn. But then I ran out of petrol. So then I tried to walk back to Berlin. and then I realized that I could just restart in the car and I would both be back there and I could fill it up with oil and things, which is how I ended up at one of the nearby towns on the way to Dresden, stocking up on things that I thought would be necessary for the journey, which also included sausages. and I didn't really know what they did, but I liked them. And then I realized that my wallet was still in the car, and because I hadn't needed any petrol, I'd left it on the street rather than go through all the kerfuffle of bringing it to the shop.
Just left it in the road?
No, I parked it.
The wallet?
No, the car with the wallet inside it. But I had also managed to accidentally, I think, leave the boot open. But anyway, it's fine. And then, so I went out, still clutching my sausages, to go.
You stole the sausages?
No, I went to get my wallet to pay for the sausages.
You can't walk out to the shop with the sausages. You haven't paid for them.
So off I went.
Me.
But
it's a sausage crime.
But the gate was now closed.
Why?
The gate across the front of the forecourt of the thing had been pulled too. Couldn't get through, couldn't get out, couldn't get to my wallet to buy my sausages. So,
do you think they closed the gate because you were trying to escape with stolen sausages?
So that's pretty much exactly it, but I didn't realise because it never occurred to me to let go of the sausages.
You're just running around holding the sausages.
I waited for a very long time and then I saved the game so I could go back and wait some more when I had some more time. And then I wrote about it on RPS, and then someone in the comment section said that actually it's because you need to put the sausages down.
And that's the line you will not cross.
It just had never occurred to me that that's a thing that I would have done. Because I wouldn't have.
Oh,
as I recall, I went back and picked up more. Like, that was my act of rebellion.
Well, if I'm stuck here, time
yeah,
to stock
it was
up.
Basically, well, whatever. I'll hold as many sausages as I damn well please.
Oh, Pip.
So, having now been told this, my trip to Dresden might still be on. Because all I need to do is put the sausages down.
Get your wallet, go back, buy them.
Oh, I don't know if I want them anymore. They're kind of a sign of my shame. And also, I don't think that you can get through the checkpoint if you're holding sausages. Because, like, I don't think you're allowed to transport former livestock across the
former
state
livestock
lines. I don't really know what this means. I don't quite know how to phrase it in legal terms.
I don't know how much this is your lack of understanding of the game. And how much is how shops work. How much sausages cost?
But like,
you understand that you can't just go and take something from a shop to your car to get money to buy it, right?
Well, yeah. Oh, it seems so obvious now. But like, I'm just not used to games sort of acting that way.
Mm. Holding you to account.
Well, essentially, I'd understand it if, you know, if I'd left the building and the cashier had said, you have to pay for that first, or you need to put that down and get your money or something.
Mm.
Like, I would totally have understood if that had happened. But because the gate seemed to be sort of sufficiently far enough away from the shop entry and exit, like, I could leave the shop and no one cared. So I didn't understand why I couldn't leave the compound.
It's because you'd stolen the sausages, Pip.
Well, yes, I mean, you say this. I assume that or it's a bug.
Yes. Bug, sausages aren't free. Bad game.
Anyway, so that's my current status with Jalopy. But I've been a bit better about repairing things and having optimal oil sort of levels and things. I found a crowbar. I mean, I bought a crowbar, but I mean...
Bought a crowbar.
No, no, I legit bought that because I'd parked my car really close, so it wasn't that I never encountered the problem.
I love that you parked your car in the road to sprint to buy sausages and then ended up trapped.
Do you never do that? Like, you don't... Because I wouldn't... I mean, like, if I was going to pop to the garage to pick up a Sprite and a
sausage roll.
I don't want a sausage roll. Okay. Like,
you don't have to have one.
Maybe, like, a muffin.
Okay.
Or something.
Sure.
You know, I'd park the car not near the petrol bit, you know, because otherwise you get in the way of the people who want to buy the petrol. Like, usually they have, like, separate...
That makes sense.
Separate
yeah.
pull-in spaces. You're right. Or I would park, you know, on the road, but sort of away from, you know, the petrol bit.
Hmm.
Anyway.
That is considerate of you.
Well, I mean, maybe this is one of the perils of being an actual driver.
That's
true. Playing
yeah.
a driving game, you know.
But... Well, sausage thievery.
I mean, you've met me. Do you not think that I would just... It wouldn't occur to me put down the sausages in real life.
It makes total sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's believable, I'll say that.
Yeah, well... But anyway, so that's my current status with the Eastern Bloc. Trapped.
Deary me.
I've still never seen Dresden. Like, it's the first thing that you do in the game. Just never got there. Like, the entirety of this whole experience with the game has just been a series of inconveniences and bugs and accidental disasters. I'm enjoying it, though.
What? It sounds like you are.
It's great. It reminds me of a terrible Citroën car that I had. His name was Spencer and he was dreadful. He could not retain water. It was really annoying and really dangerous. Got overtaken by a lorry going uphill once. That was shameful. The lorry beeped me. Anyway, shall I tick that off?
Tick it.
Tick. Yeah. And the last one is Mushroom 11, which I've only played a tiny bit of, so we don't have to talk about it if you don't want to.
Well, what is it?
So it is a puzzle platformer, but you are kind of in charge of a mushroom growth fungal sort of...
Happening.
...thing. It's a sort of loose agglomeration of cells. Mm. And so what you actually are in control of is your cursor functions as an eraser, and what you erase then appears on a different part of the fungal cell. So essentially it tries to keep its same mass, but as you remove parts of it from one side, it generates the same amount on the other side, and so you can use that to build up momentum, or you can use it to shape the growth into particular forms if you want to cross a bridge, or if you want to sort of go down a level and avoid a sort of an acid pit or something. You can kind of gradually shape it so that it hooks onto a level above, and then you gradually try and force it to grow into a different sort of area. And
that's cool.
And then yeah, so I'm actually really liking it. I think it's a couple of years old now, but I picked it up because I realized I'd not played it, and I'd seen it at a whole bunch of events like EGX and Rezzed and things like that, and so I just wanted to give it a go. And it's actually been really interesting, and I really like it because it's not an exact one-to-one thing in terms of what gets deleted and what gets created.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sort of a delay, and you can end up with a situation where you're hurriedly erasing to try and keep the momentum going, but you end up erasing too much and you don't quite have enough mass to actually make it to the next surface that you can even hinge onto, and there's a whole bunch of things that will eat away at your mass as well as you toddle along, for want of a better word. And I'm only a couple of levels into it, but already it's been quite challenging, actually. And some of that is to do with having not quite worked out the optimal rate at which you wiggle the mouse to erase as you are trying to just move forwards. And then the other stuff that's been quite difficult has been sort of just getting to grips with the way that the... So in some of the sections, you'll need to separate one bit of fungus away from the rest and then have it drop down somewhere or have it do something. And then as you erase the other stuff, it starts to repopulate this new bit that's been separated and is now, you know, you're using that to, I don't know, like activate a weight switch or something, but you needed to still be in another section with the other bit. And, you know, I don't think I've explained that hugely well. So I guess I'll try and give an actual example. So say you've got like a long thin tube almost, and at some point along the tube, there is a gate that is barring the way for the fungal matter. But there's also a switch that will let the gate lift. So what you do is you separate off part of the mass. You leave part of it on the switch. When the gate opens, you move some of it through, and as long as some of it's through, you can then erase everything on the other side and it will suddenly appear.
Right, that makes sense.
Through.
Yeah.
And so there's variations on that that I'm starting to encounter, but sometimes when you erase, it doesn't necessarily grow on the bit that you think it will. Mm. And so you can sometimes end up with these situations where the thing that you thought would be the seed where things could start growing from on the other side of this gate will suddenly just not be the thing, and you'll just have accidentally erased all of the progress that you were making. And
right, yeah, I see.
And it'll start sort of like going off in a different direction unintentionally. So it's little things like that where I think I'm still getting to grips with how those bits of the physics work and the little delays and how it prioritizes where it's going to put the extra mass that you're deleting. Mm. But other than that, it's actually been really interesting and I really like it. So that's one that I definitely will be going back to. And I'm finding it sort of far more satisfying and intuitive than... I mean, it's a very different game than Polybridge, but in the sense of it being a physics thing and a thing that you sort of learn really well from your mistakes, I'd say this is, you know, it does so much that's really good on that front.
Cool. That's exciting.
Mm.
Can I tell you about something? Pants.
Is it literal pants?
No.
Rubbish. Oh. Yes, go.
So... relatively recently, like not, well, I missed it by a couple of weeks, I think, but Street Fighter V finally got its story mode, like its proper story mode. It had something already.
I saw this.
Yeah. So if you're not aware, Street Fighter V was released experimentally early by Capcom, who decided to sort of release the bare bones of the game and do subsequent fighters as DLC and stuff. And there are ideas in that approach that make a lot of sense. It makes, you know, these are some of the oldest serious competitive games in the world. And traditionally they've been, you know, they don't get patched. They're arcade machines. They get patched when someone releases the Turbo Edition a year later or something like that. Whereas now they're kind of embracing the idea that this could be a living game and can receive patches and updates and new characters and so on. And that's had a big shake-up effect on the matter. And that's fine. That's interesting. Had server problems when it launched, and that was a big problem. But the main issue it had was that it just was missing stuff. Mm. Not necessarily new stuff either, like new features. It was missing like an arcade mode that worked like a traditional fighting game arcade mode. Had a survival mode that wasn't as good. And a bunch of other things beside. But one thing they sort of promised was coming was like a sort of cinematic story mode, which is sort of in place of the way individual character stories worked in old Street Fighter. So in old Street Fighter, like most old fighting games, you pick a character, and then you see that character's introduction, then you fight the same series of fighters as everybody else. You maybe get one special battle tuned to that character's story, and then you see an epilogue, and that's it. And it's just, you know, bookended. The new one has like a tutorial for each character, but it's like, and it always had this, but it's like, again, like a series of sort of cartoon panels explaining something that's happening and attached to a run of trivially easy fights that just sort of propel you to the next one. They're all really short, like three battles long.
Is this the story that's like super revolving around Captain Buffalo or whatever his name is?
Captain Buffalo.
Yes. Is that not his name?
M. Bison?
He's got a hat. Yes.
God, I had to dig that one out.
What? It's quite similar. Why are you laughing at me? Oh.
He's Captain Buffalo. Captain, yes, Captain Buffalo is definitely in it.
I'd forgotten his rank.
What other Street Fighter characters are there?
Ken.
Yeah.
Ryu.
Mm.
Cammy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. I don't think we've got another Captain Buffalo in there waiting to happen, Pip, so let's move on.
Lita?
Who?
Sven? I don't know.
Okay.
Who else is in it?
Balrog? Jury?
Yeah, Jury. Vega. I've seen pictures of her. She's new. She's on the news now.
Mm, she's on the news.
Well, I mean, you know, recent.
Captain Buffalo. Okay, so, yes, Captain Buffalo's the bad guy. He looks a bit like Stalin.
He wears a blue hat, right?
Red hat.
Okay.
Unless you're palette swapping him.
So sure that he was blue. Anyway.
We might be talking about different people, but I just... The only thing I can get from Buffalo is bison, so...
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll go with that. But what's he up to, then?
Anyway, so basically, well, to give a bit more context, so the... this cinematic story thing they're doing is intended to basically mimic a structure that NetherRealm Studios came up with for their new Mortal Kombat games and also Injustice, the DC Universe fighting game that's getting a sequel pretty soon.
Hmm.
And they had kind of a good idea. Like, I never really gave a shit about Mortal Kombat, but what they did with the narrative mode in I think Mortal Kombat 9 and Mortal Kombat X. Was quite cool in both cases. I mean, the story is not, you know, going to blow anybody's mind, but they basically retold the story of the three original games. Rather than having you play as one character and seeing their version of it, they created, like, essentially like a kind of animated movie in engine that sort of seamlessly transitions into fights that you then play as a character, and then eventually the story will shift you onto a different character, you'll play as them for a bit. And so it's quite a good idea, and it worked well in Injustice as well, where over the course of, you know, a basically full-length game campaign, so 8 to 10 hours, you take in a story, there's lots of, you know, cutscenes and stuff, but also you play as every character in a relatively informative way. So you're sort of introduced to stuff. And by the time you've finished it all, you probably know which characters you like. And if you're going to move on to multiplayer, you probably know which characters you want to try and master and so on. That's fine. And I would assume that it'd be a relatively easy format to imitate, because you take a pretty simple story, you string it together, you have the player drop in to play as one character and you get used to them and you move on to a different character and so on. And relatively hard to fuck up. However, the story mode to Street Fighter V, which is called The Shadow Falls, is...
Chun-Li
is in it. It is actually genuinely appalling. Like, it's... So the story itself should be basically like the Room of games. And games didn't really need, as in the Tommy Wiseau movie, like, games didn't really need any help being totally baffling nonsense in some cases.
Yeah.
But, and I have a soft spot for real shit. And I was getting, my patience for it faded quite quickly. So they've made a really baffling decision to set the story of Street Fighter V, I think, between the stories of Street Fighter 2 and Street Fighter 3.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's like Street Fighter, I don't know, I thought it was like 3.5, maybe, or 2.5.
I think it's 2.5. I think it's Street Fighter 2.5, and it's actually Street Fighter 5. But it's all,
did anything interesting happen between 2 and 3?
But
then?
Also, those are 20-year-old games.
Huh.
So those are 20-year-old games that had no obvious story if you weren't reading around them. And so if you're not into Street Fighter fandom, and you don't have a good memory for that stuff, or you didn't pay attention to it in the first place. Like, if you only ever played Street Fighter with your mates, you wouldn't have any idea who anyone is, or why this character's a zombie now, or anything. So, it is not only uninterested in explaining anything that's happening, it's completely uninterested in giving any character a reason to do anything, and to even stay in the same place for any amount of time. Like, so one of the reasons that sort of Mortal Kombat worked, I think, is it took its time with each character, but also their stories chained into each other in a relatively meaningful way. And they fucked that really badly with Street Fighter. So it opens with a guy called Charlie Nash, who has died, probably, or something, having a dream where he sees a sheep.
Right.
And then the sheep melts and turns into a dreadlocked demon warrior called Nekali, who's one of the new characters.
So is this screams, a Kojima production?
Who screams devour at him until he wakes up. But he wakes up in a sarcophagus in South America, where he is attended by a Russian woman in a miniskirt and a Yushanka. Who?
What's a Yushanka?
Like that Russian hat.
I've got one.
Yeah. Who says something to him in Russian for a bit, but then enigmatically flounces away, at which point he's confronted by a ghost or a hologram of Captain Buffalo, who he then fights and defeats, but does he? And so on. It then cuts, for some reason, to Ryu, who is going to see Dalzim, who is the sort of...
Oh, I know that
the
name.
Indian yoga
master. Is he
master,
the guy the with the long arms?
Yeah, the bendy man. Bendy yoga man.
Stretch Armstrong.
And Ryu says, I need your help. But you never find out what he needs his help with. And Dalzim
reaching
says...
something.
Dalzim says, I will help you. And then adopts like a fighty stance. And then they fight.
What?
And now you're Ryu, from having been... Charlie.
Is his help to teach you
I don't
fighting?
Know.
Or...
No, they just fight. They fight for no reason. Oh. And then their fighting is interrupted by the arrival of Nekali again, who really? Turns into a puddle or something. And then you have to fight him as... But then you have to fight... So no, the Ryu gets ready to fight Nekali while Dalzim stands in front of a man, just for some reason. And but then as you jump into that fight, an arrow comes down and points at Nekali and says, you...
What?
As in, you're him now. Because Nekali has to win that fight. So you always play the character who wins. But it means that you're constantly jumping between characters as the story dictates.
Right.
So then you play as him. I think then you play as Dalzim again. Then you go somewhere completely different. And it changes character with everything.
Mm.
And...
Does it actually teach you how to fight as
no,
them?
No, not in the slightest. It doesn't even try.
The idea is that you'll have already learnt how to fight as them by playing the other bits of Street Fighter that they dished
out. Well, yeah,
because
it can't take the time to teach you anything. The battles also need to be trivially easy, so it doesn't really matter what you do. So there's no, like, real... It's just... You're just mashing... Essentially, you mash a button so that you get to see the next place.
I could do this!
The next cutscene... And anyway, the story is actually about some big space orbs that are like EMPs, but they've been programmed by children and they're like big purple disco balls, but they're controlled by evil chess pieces that need to be plugged into a big purple computer. But different characters have different ones, and Rashid, who's like a guy who's a master of wind, has to get them for some reason, but Guile also has one. And then basically everyone is arguing in a big bank vault. And then Captain Buffalo strangles Chun-Li and then throws her somewhere. But then Cammy's there. And then Charlie shows up, but he's like in front of a big fire. Then he takes Guile's chess piece, but then he disagrees with Rashid, who runs away with a different chess piece. But then they meet in a bar later in Russia for some reason, and the woman with the Ushanka is there. And then Jury kicks down the door. Then Jury decides that she has to fight both of them for no reason, and so on.
It sounds like it's remembering a really convoluted but tedious dream.
Yes. No, honestly, God, it's like... that was what I was attempting to demonstrate by trying to recount even just the first hour of it.
Or even just like a really, really irritating student art show where they've just decided that throwing every bit of nonsense at the wall constitutes surrealism.
Honestly, this would be the perfect opportunity for them to reintroduce those characters and actually maybe introduce the idea of a Street Fighter story mode to the world in a way that was accessible and allowed you to learn what each of the characters were about and so on. And it's not that. It is like hammering a button to get somebody to continue to tell you about their dream they had.
That sounds awful.
It's fucking terrible. And the stupid thing is, that game is amazing. That is a beautifully made fighting game at its core. Like, the thing they have to do...
Are all the server issues and stuff sorted?
They seem a lot better. Yeah, okay. It seems a lot better. The thing they have to do, they have nailed it. It's great. They keep fucking up. They keep Capcom, and that game is like you and Jalopy. Like, they're learning, but I don't know how they keep getting themselves in these situations. Like, you know, I think they accidentally this week manages to, they've released a new character, but they've sort of broken it so she can't be out on certain territories. So you can get her if you're in Europe, but anywhere else, they can't fix it, apparently. She just won't go.
Really?
Like, it's these stupid things. She's trapped in the sausage factory, whatever it was. Like, it's a strange, strange thing. It's funny primarily because none of the problems it has seem hard.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, writing a good story for a game is difficult, but writing a story that bad looks harder.
Yeah. Or even, like, you could have just introduced individual tutorials, you know?
It has tutorials. They're just in a separate mode.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, it has all that stuff. You want to learn stuff. But there's no real sense of, like, what order you should do anything in. It's a hilarious mess. It's probably worth watching some YouTube videos of it just to get a sense of how bad it is.
I don't want to, though. I've been bored enough by your research.
Oh, God, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just joking. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, the way that you've explained it to me is actually, you've been entertaining, but the story itself just sounds like, why would I want to watch somebody play through
this? That's diplomatic of you, but no, I don't know either.
No.
Oh, well. So that's how I valuably used my time this week.
Well, I'm sorry for you. For your loss.
Indeed.
Of all those precious seconds when you could have been clicking away on
them. No one knows what a second is, Pip.
No one does. Shall we do questions from questions?
Sure.
Great.
Let's get into it. Mike T writes... sorry, excuse me. He didn't write that. That was me. In episode 149, you discussed the case of mistaken self-identity in Nazi Republic. What are your thoughts on the indoctrination hypothesis in Mass Effect 3 in comparison and or contrast? My personal headcanon for the ending of Mass Effect 3 is that Shepard was indoctrinated, but she fought it off and woke up to fight a rearguard action for the Andromeda mission and other similar efforts. Thanks for remembering, Mike T. Pip, I don't believe you remember much about the ending or endings of...
No.
So, I'm probably it's relatively brief.
I don't think I ever played the new ending either. I only ever played the earlier one.
Yeah, it doesn't change it massively.
I really can't remember much of it. So, I think, you go ahead.
I mean, I fully support people having like their own headcanon versions of what happened. And to be honest, like my memory of the exact details of that indoctrination hypothesis isn't good enough to like argue it, although I remember disagreeing with it when it presented as this is the actual ending. I think the reason I have never really gelled with it is that this idea that there was a sort of secret ending to Mass Effect, which was that, you know, your perception of certain things hadn't been correct all along because of the Reapers and so on. I don't really gel with, simply because it was so much a product of the fan backlash to the original ending, which I would still contest wasn't that bad. And I think the thing I found so disappointing about the way that game's legacy was established almost straight away was that, and, you know, minor spoilers for what is now a 4-year-old game, but people seem so not okay with it not having a 100% happy ending. And I know there's more to it than that, and there were certainly problems with it, but particularly the, you know, the indoctrination ending was a way to find a sort of a happier solution to sort of make the situations that the characters find themselves in the end less compromised and less sort of brutal in some ways. And I think that if you look at some of the making of stuff or some of the things that were left in the files for the game, the original ending was a lot darker than the one they even released initially. And then they brightened it up far more with the extended cut, which all of which was in response to the fact that the, even though, as I say, I think there are a lot of legitimate things that could have been better about it, the sheer volume and violence of the toys being thrown out of pram party that took place when it ended was, I think, really disappointing and a big sign that, you know, games were pretty strictly limited in the types of stories they could tell and the types of endings they could aspire to, simply because people wouldn't accept it if it wasn't the "it's your birthday and we all got you a cake" ending. And yeah, like, I wouldn't have had the spirit of the Citadel be a little kid either, but I still admired that the ending sort of challenged you to think about what parts of the mythology you attached to, and also to accept that people weren't going to get out of that alive, and to accept that the things that Shepard had seen and done would mean that he or she couldn't get out of it without being profoundly affected or destroyed or something else by it. So for all those reasons, I'm not a massive fan. But I mean, but when it comes to individuals going, I want to believe that this happened, there's absolutely no harm in that, particularly because it seems unlikely that Andromeda is going to interact much with the Shepard story.
The Shepardiverse.
The Shepardiverse. Well, I mean, it's part of the same universe, but, you know, it's not going to be... There'll be a cute reference, but probably not, like, Garrus isn't going to show up and be your friend now.
No. Oh.
Because that'd be weird.
Fine. Not playing it anymore.
Patrick writes... A close friend of mine who really only plays mobile games came to me after buying and playing Civ Beyond Earth from a Steam sale. She told me she felt very overwhelmed and didn't really understand what to do regardless of the in-game tutorial. Being the person that plays the most games in her life, she came to me. I recommended that she play Civ 5, but she was more interested in the space theme than a traditional Civ game. Any recommendations? More broadly, do you feel that a generation of people, who grew up playing mobile games are bouncing off more complex games like the Civilization series and other 4X games due to their slower pace, longer play sessions, and less frequent rewards? How do you think this increase of mobile gamers will affect the way these games are designed in the future? Thanks, Patrick. By way of recommendations, I'd suggest Endless Space, which was Amplitude's first 4X game. They went on to make Endless Legend, which is great. Endless Legend is probably the better game, but if the space theme is needed, then I would give Endless Space a go. It's not a simple game by any means, but it has an absolutely gorgeous UI. And I think that makes a big difference when someone's being confronted with... Because, I mean, I tend to believe that mechanics, pretty much anyone can get their head around mechanics eventually. It's interface and the way that information is initially presented to somebody that's what creates the impression that something's not for them.
I don't know. Like, I'm not from a mobile gaming background, but I still find 4X to be a complete sort of impenetrable, for the most part, sort of genre that I just can't get to grips with, and I don't get pleasure from trying to. And so I would say that from that, I wouldn't say that it's a casualty of people's attention spans diminishing or being used to sort of mobile game free-to-play style reward loops. I mean, you know, maybe there's some of that to it if somebody is particularly into that as their reward system or whatever, but I would say that I just don't find them compelling. And I'm, you know, I don't mind complexity. I don't mind sort of having to learn a lot of sort of systems. I mean, hell, I wouldn't have persevered with the MOBAs that I've persevered with if I was repelled by complexity and the need to spend a lot of time on something. But I just do not get off on, you know, the graph management and the, you know, the diplomacy side of things and the, you know, juggling of the specific win conditions or, you know, territory encroachment and things like that. And I especially bounce off it if friends are involved. So things like Neptune's Pride or things like, you know, I will not play anymore.
I mean, like, if we're talking about somebody who is attracted to those things but is put off by the complexity, which is the opposite, I guess, then I'm trying to figure out what their answer is. Because, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if a generation of people playing game on mobile were completely cool with the idea of management strategy and turn-based games and that sort of thing, because so many popular mobile games are turn-based management games of some kind or another.
It might be that mobile is a good ground for that to try and penetrate or improve on, because smaller screens and sort of the way that you have to interface with a smartphone means that you do naturally need to limit the amount of information that is being presented on screen at any one time, because otherwise it's so small that you can't even functionally read it or parse it. And so I wonder whether actually maybe people trying to make games for that medium would be one way of experimenting with different types of data presentation that might actually, you know, feed back onto PC.
Yeah.
If they work, or if they're sort of easier for people to actually just pick up and get running with. Because I've, you know, I did that thing of I nearly picked up Stellaris in the Steam sale just as a kind of almost like a personal challenge to sort of see whether I could get back into a game like that or at least try. But, you know, just even looking at pictures of the the screenshots, just, you know, cold sweat, you know, kind of, oh.
I mean, I would hope that, yeah, that if rather than leading to, I hate accusations of dumbing down and stuff, but rather than that, I think mobile games prove that there is a market for these ideas, at least, or ideas like this. There's probably a bit beyond what they reach on PC generally, and that anything games can do to present those same kind of pleasures in a more accessible way or work a bit harder on their interface and their, you know, notification system and so on is worthwhile. Like, yeah, I think, you know, Patrick was right to recommend Civ 5 because it has a very, you know, good UI. Hopefully Civ 6 will be equally good. I mean, you can't really fix the theme problem in that case, but nonetheless, I think the evidence is there that, you know, developers are finding benefit in streamlining stuff without sacrificing the complexity of the decisions you're making, which is the key thing. Like, a complicated menu can have no decisions associated with it, or a complicated screen can have no decisions associated with it, whereas a really simple game with a couple of buttons can be, you know, all you need. Like, Civ's way of punting you to the next interesting decision every time you click end turn is the best thing about it. So, yeah. I mean, it's a shame that maybe there isn't a game in this particular case. The other thing that might work is Civ Revolution, which I think was the stripped-down console mobile version of Civ. But again, it doesn't have the theme required.
Yeah, I'm trying to think for space stuff. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think I would have quite liked Neptune's Pride if I'd been playing it on a team with someone.
Mm.
You know, so it wouldn't have felt quite so much like everybody else was super into that kind of game and I was just there and I was just gradually doomed and, you know, wasn't quite understanding how to optimize production on particular things or, you know, I'd done my ship slightly wrong. And when you feel like you're so far behind on a curve, then almost it doesn't feel like you can learn much by playing because, you know, obviously you would need to learn by what asking your opponents who aren't going to tell you what they're doing. And it starts to feel like a really sort of long slog towards defeat. And so, but I think I would have at least persevered with it longer or got more out of it if it hadn't just been me, if it had been me and a friend who did understand maybe a bit more and could sort of say, I think we should do this and here's why. Yeah. But what would you actually like to do?
Mm.
Or at least I could sort of say, I'm going to go over here, but is there anything that I've completely not factored in, or does this planet actually need to specialize in something else, or, you know, things like that. The other thing that might be interesting in terms of it having quite a light theme and quite sort of light, it's not super, super, super heavy on mechanics. But I mean, you know, it's that competitive multiplayer thing rather than a different style sort of foot. But the game that I Subterfuge.
Mm.
Like, do you think that would be a thing that you would
I don't think I would, because it's not really about the satisfaction of building a civilization or building an empire. Like, it's a competitive strategy game, certainly.
And there is territory sort of.
Yeah, I think it depends exactly why this friend bought Civ. Yeah. Because really, I think Civ is a single player thing.
Yeah, that's fair. It's more of a kind of you sink into a Zen sort of thing.
Management
where
you're growing a garden, basically, of cities and so on. I mean, Subterfuge definitely isn't that.
Yeah.
The only other thing I would suggest, and it sort of relates to the play with a friend thing, if you can, is probably watching YouTube series, like campaign series or something, on a game is a good way to learn it. That wasn't available before and gives you that sense of kind of playing alongside somebody or watching somebody else play while you learn. So that's an idea. If the effort or if the intent is to kind of stick with Civ Beyond Earth. Finally, Post-Internet Syndrome writes, if there was a magical ray gun that turned people into games, what game would you turn into? This came up on another podcast I listened to. They had a very entertaining discussion on the topic, and I'd like to hear what games embody your personalities. He says, or she says, I think I would become Assassin's Creed, one of the later games in the franchise. I tend to have big plans, but then I settle for the tried and true anyway. I get fixated on small issues while missing the big picture, but at least I'm reasonably good looking and kind of entertaining sometimes. Would this be more fun if we picked each other's game?
I don't know, because I don't know whether this is the sort of thing which, you know, then would lead to a massive fight on the lawn. Like, if you pick anything twee or whimsical.
I was going to pick black and white.
Why? Wait, what? Why?
So, you know, the old Lionhead game.
Where you can prod someone with your... Oh, is that it?
So, well, bear with me. So... It's a game that is basically quite, it's substantially unlike any other game of its genre, really. And it has really specific and different ideas about how you go about doing things in it, which involves attempting to corral a willful and morally variable creature into attempting to behave itself as it dances, feeds on villagers, throws things at stuff, regardless of your poking. But it's, you know, also kind of a rare example of something genuinely, you know, different and, dare I say it, special. And also, I ran a website dedicated to it for several years in my teenagehood. Ignore that last bit.
At what point did this analogy slide over into... Oh, no. Now I have to... I don't... That was quite a good mixture of digs and sort of ultimately nothing that I could take too much issue with.
Take note, people. That's how you do it. That's how you softly insult somebody. No, it's actually a game I admire very much.
You respect greatly.
I think Black and White's great. It's just weird and capricious and willful.
Yeah. I don't know, because the thing is, I'm operating on the basis of, I quite like Chris, so I'm thinking of games I quite like, but I'd
be Clock Simulator, wouldn't I?
But there's also, you know, like, I'm trying to think whether you correspond to Viva Pinata.
Why would that be?
Well, I quite like it.
Okay.
You see, this is the problem, really, isn't it? And then you try and retrofit it, and it doesn't work, because it's just about hitting animals. Or, like, I don't know.
I don't think what I'd be.
I don't know. I was really panicking that you were going to say that I was, like, grow home.
No. I thought about Katamari Damacy for a bit. But I'm always thinking about Katamari Damacy, so that's not
you. You just want to impress the prince. Or the king. Hang on. You are the prince.
Thanks.
No, I mean...
I genuinely am struggling to think of a series I'd be.
Yeah.
I want to be Dishonored, I think.
Go on. How are you going to make that fit?
Well, like, kind of based on a good old idea, but with, like, you know...
Whales,
no, like... I'm not saying I am. I'm saying I want to be, which is sort of like, you know, distinguished and artistically credible, but also kind of cool with the kids. That's Dishonored. That's not me. Jesus.
I feel like I haven't really fulfilled my part of the bargain.
No. Well.
No. I'm trying to think of other games that I've even played at this point. Like Dota, who require thousands of hours to try and understand.
Maybe it'll be Tribes. An ultimately unviable format.
Well, maybe you could be Clock Simulator.
That's what I was saying.
An ultimately unreliable judge of time.
That's specific enough to be true.
Yeah, no, this is hard. This is really difficult.
I'll take Clock Simulator.
Yeah.
Passively amusing. And honestly, you're just entertained that someone bothered to make it.
Sure. You delivered your own sick burn.
I can, yeah, it's omnidirectional.
Yeah, no, this is good. I should have just let you get on with it.
So the one thing I definitely know about time.
Yes.
Is that's all the time we have for questions.
Oh, great. I mean, well, you know, I'm trying to be positive about this. Good.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode where I promise there'll be a Tom. At least one. You can do so by emailing us at questions@creightonkrowbar.com. You can leave a question on the forum at creightonkrowbar.com/forum. You can tweet us at creightonkrowbar. You can discuss this episode on the forum or on Discord at... Well, I'll put the link in the show notes and also in the sidebar of the website, which I will update at some point when I can be bothered, but thank you for reminding me. If you'd like to follow us as individuals, I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
Oh, yes, well.
And you are?
Well,
Captain Buffalo.
Well, yes, I was going to try and pretend to be Tom again, but then I wasn't sure which Tom, and then I didn't want to sort of mess up the spelling again, so I thought maybe I'd just not.
But with that in mind.
I mean, oh, sorry, yes, no, at Philippa War, which is at PHILIPPAWARR.
Excellent.
I mean, but I
was going to say, we've done so many episodes of this and you still have to spell it out on your fingers. But then I realised it's just your actual name that you've had for several decades.
But everyone calls me Pip.
Why isn't your Twitter handle Pip then?
Well, I mean, my Twitter handle wasn't even Philippa Waugh for a long time.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I don't think Pip was available by the time I came anywhere near it. And Philippa Waugh is my business name, you know, for business, for legal documentation and my grown-up wheelings and dealings. And so I figured that if somebody found my byline on something, they might, if they Googled it and they found my Twitter that was still my same name, then that would be less confusing, would it not?
Captain Buffalo.